From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, filling in for Terry Gross. When Marine Captain Josh Rushing was featured in Control Room, the documentary about how the military dealt with the press during the Iraq War, he had no idea the impact he would have on audiences. Rushing was spokesperson for CENTCOM last year at the time of the Iraq War. Many viewers felt Rushing stood out for his conviction, sincerity, and open-mindedness. Recently, Rushing retired from the Marines after 14 years, in part because the Pentagon told him to stop commenting on the film. On today's Fresh Air, we speak with Josh Rushing. Also, critic-at-large John Powers reviews The Battle of Algiers. The nearly 40-year-old film is now out on DVD. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Arabic television has aired a videotape in which Osama bin Laden addresses the American public. The al-Qaeda leader said the U.S. can avoid another September 11th-style attacks if it stops threatening the security of Muslims. Bin Laden claimed that he ordered the 9/11 attacks and said he did it because of Israeli and U.S. injustices against the Lebanese and Palestinians. NPR's David Wellness says the Bush administration responded almost immediately.
White House spokesman Scott McClellan in Columbus, Ohio, said our intelligence community has said they believe it is authentic, it being the bin Laden tape. He said it was taped recently, and he said the tape is currently being analyzed. Quote, if there is actionable intelligence on it, we will act, unquote, McClellan said. He said that there is no immediate change in the threat level in the U.S. in response to the bin Laden tape. And he did not answer questions about whether the bin Laden tape may have been deliberately designed to sway the election next week.
NPR's David Wellner. Democratic challenger John Kerry also responded to the tape, pledging to go after terrorists.
As Americans, we are absolutely united in our determination to hunt down and destroy Osama bin Laden and the terrorists. They are barbarians. And I will stop at absolutely nothing to hunt down, capture, or kill the terrorists wherever they are, whatever it takes. Period.
Senator John Kerry campaigning today in Florida. The effort to reform the country's intelligence apparatus has been put on hold until after the election. House and Senate negotiators said today that they've temporarily given up their attempt to craft a reform bill that would pass both chambers. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
Advocates of intelligence reform believed the recommendations of the bipartisan 9/11 Commission, plus the endorsement by families of the 9/11 victims, plus the support of both presidential candidates, would produce a bill that could pass Congress. But Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine, who led the Senate side negotiators, says the reformers have had to lower their expectations.
We're fast learning there's a reason that intelligence reform has been blocked over the past 50 years, time and time again. It is extremely difficult to accomplish.
An issue that got in the way of past reform efforts came up again in these negotiations. The conferees could not agree on whether to put the Pentagon's vast intelligence budget under the control of a civilian office, in this case a new national intelligence director. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 23 points to close at 10,027 in heavy trading. The Dow was up 270 for the week. The Nasdaq lost a fraction to 1975. This is NPR News. Today is the last day for early voting in Georgia ahead of the November 2nd elections, and the program has produced a crush of people at designated polling stations across the state. Bruce Kennedy reports from member station WABE in Atlanta.
Mist and fog covered the several hundred people waiting outside the DeKalb County Courthouse at 7 o'clock this morning. Susie and Arthur Davis were the first in line. They had arrived at the courthouse steps just after 5 a.m.
I want to get my vote in early and on time. That's the way I am.
Ditto. I think voting is important. I don't want to wait until Tuesday because the line's long now. I think they're going to be much longer then.
Dwayne Truex, who showed up with his two children, said his wife had unsuccessfully waited 3.5 hours the night before to vote and was back in line this morning.
Well, it's certainly polarized, and I feel fairly passionately about my choices this year.
Despite the large turnout for early voting, another 3 million Georgia voters are expected to cast their ballots next Tuesday. For NPR News, I'm Bruce Kennedy in Atlanta.
Chief Justice William Rehnquist has been released from Bethesda Naval Hospital after a week of treatment for thyroid cancer. A spokesman for the court said the 80-year-old jurist expects to be back at work next week. Officials have not revealed details of Rehnquist's cancer or its treatment, but it did say that he underwent a tracheotomy. Medical experts have said that could be an indication that the Chief Justice's cancer is particularly aggressive. Rehnquist's illness has highlighted the possibility that whoever wins next week's presidential election could appoint one or more new Supreme Court justices. In stocks, the S&P gave 2 points to close at 11:30. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from AARP, 35 million members dedicated to creating social change. AARP, the power to make it better. AARP.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest today is former U.S. Marine Corps Captain Josh Rushing, who was a prominent figure in the documentary Control Room. The film is just out on DVD. Rushing was the Central Command, or CENTCOM, press officer whose job was to represent the Marines to the worldwide media covering the war in Iraq, including the Arab TV network Al Jazeera. Because Rushing was relatively candid about how he thought the war was progressing and how it was being covered by the media, he was one of the most memorable figures in the film. Control Room includes many conversations between Rushing and a producer from Al Jazeera, Hassan Ibrahim. Let's listen to one of their exchanges.
To an average viewer, what do they see on television? American tanks in the center of Baghdad. That's what they see. That's what I'm trying to convey to you.
To me, an occupation would be us ruling the center of town and raising the American flag.
Try to put yourself in the place of an average Arab viewer. The Arab viewer sitting in a coffee shop in Cairo, Damascus, Amman, Khartoum, Morocco. Just that. Simple viewer. That simple
person.
Okay,
I see what you're saying. You're not talking facts. You're talking their perception.
Yes.
I see how it could be perceived as that. I do. But there's a feeling in America that there's an instability in this region. Do you hear what I'm saying, though? That there's
instability. But they're going to the wrong place. It's the Arab-Israeli conflict.
I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah, but why don't they want to do anything about it? They're doing nothing about it. And it's increasing the anger.
If I get out of the Marine Corps and do anything, I want to do something with the Palestinian issue. I don't think Americans are getting good information about it. I really don't. But no American connects the Palestinian issue and this issue. They're completely different. They might as well be on different sides of the world as far as they're concerned. But I've yet to meet anyone in this part of the world that sees them as not the same issue. Everyone here sees them as the exact same thing.
That's Josh Rushing and Hassan Ibrahim in a scene from Control Room. As the documentary gained attention, the Marine Corps ordered Rushing to decline interview requests related to the film. Rushing resigned from the Marines earlier this month. He spoke to Terry this week about his experiences in the job and what led to his departure.
I had been thinking about getting out before. When I was at the war, there was a point where I decided I've done this for 14 years. I enlisted as a young man. I think I went to a recruiter when I was 17. Actually, was 18 when I went to boot camp, and I'm now 32 years old. So my entire adult life, I've been nothing other than a Marine, and just decided that I probably should go somewhere else. However, I absolutely love Marines, and I love being a Marine, and I love the Marine Corps, and I'm not sure I would have ever pulled the trigger had all the events of this last year not happened, which, and you may ask me about this, but were a complete surprise to me. I didn't realize that there was even a movie Control Room when it showed at Sundance. All this was kind of a complete ambush, and I'm hoping
What do you mean it was an ambush?
Well, I went to my office one day in L.A., and there was a voicemail on the machine where, and I swear it went something like this: "Hey, you don't know me, but I just saw your movie at Sundance, and man, thanks. Good job." And hung up. And I thought, that's bizarre. I wasn't even aware Sundance was going on or had just happened over the weekend. This was the Monday after Sundance. So I sit down at the computer and I Google Josh Rushing and Sundance, and Control Room pops up. Still no idea what this is. So I start Googling Control Room Josh Rushing and getting a bunch of the reviews and the links. And I mean, it's not just a movie. It's a movie that, you know, I'm one of the three main, I guess, not characters, but main figures in a documentary. And it's very political in nature. And a lot of these, and I have not seen the movie when I'm reading all this, but a lot of reviews are using me kind of as the anti-Bush administration poster boy. You know, like they would take a quote, and I don't remember which quotes they chose, took a quote from me, and they would say, you know, this wasn't said by someone from France or a Greenpeace activist. This was by our own government spokesperson kind of thing. And I thought, oh, man, I'm really going to hear about this.
But wait a minute. Did you not know a movie was being made? Like when you were being filmed in conversation with journalists from Al Jazeera and journalists from the American Press Corps, did you not know it was for a movie?
That's an absolutely fair question. There were hundreds of reporters there, and I gave hundreds of interviews. I gave a ton of interviews to Al Jazeera, and particularly Xinhua in China. I was fairly popular there, from what I understand. A number of European channels, Israeli TV, American news channels from Fox and others. But and this was over a pretty long period of time. Well, during one short period of time, I would imagine, and I'm trying to remember, a week or two, Jahan, who I didn't know at the time, but relatively young, well, actually a young, attractive American Egyptian gal. And
this is the director of the movie, yeah.
Yeah, it turns out to be the director of the movie. But to me at the time, they were introduced through the American University at Cairo. So I honestly believed that it was along the lines of a student film. And I think that's one of the reasons that when the request came into our office, it was me, the junior guy, who ends up getting it. It kind of tumbled down the chain and like, all right, whatever, you do this kind of thing.
And maybe that's also why you were saying things that you otherwise perhaps wouldn't have said?
I hope not.
Uh-huh.
I hope to think that I believed the things that I said, and I hope that I spoke with conviction. And I don't know, maybe a little embarrassed at this point to admit it, but I really did believe a lot of the arguments at the time for us going to war. When Colin Powell went in front of the UN and said those things, I repeated them nearly verbatim as, you know, look, we've got the evidence. And I think today, at least in a lot of circles, my friends, it's easy to want to appear as if you've been against it the whole time and you were always kind of cynical of it. But that was not the case with me. When our government said it, I believed it and I repeated it.
No, it was your job at CENTCOM to explain the American military position to the American press corps and to the international press corps, particularly the Arab press corps. And so you had to explain, and there's a scene of you doing this in the control room, you had to explain that we invaded Iraq because of weapons of mass destruction. You say, we believe that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction and that they have the will to use those weapons against us. And you're talking at the time to a journalist from Al Jazeera who's very skeptical of what you're telling him. What was it like when you learned that there weren't weapons of mass destruction in Iraq?
Wow. I tell you when it hit me was when Colin Powell on Tim Russert, I believe, said that the information he presented at the UN in, I think, February about our evidence of those weapons was not only incorrect, but he believed it was intentionally manipulated to produce a desired result. That's when it hit me. Because it was specifically his speech that I listened to. Matter of fact, one of the first things I did after, it may have been late January, after I got to CENTCOM was, I remember watching that speech there, going online and downloading it, printing it, making copies of it, and handing it out to all the new spokespeople as they got there and kind of checked in. So everybody was on the same sheet of music because this is what I believed was the truth. I guess I feel kind of personally duped by someone somewhere along the lines.
You had to explain America's actions to the press. Who explained them to you? Who briefed you before you briefed the press?
As a spokesperson for Central Command, we were all tasked with reading everything that the president said, Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, any of those individuals. And they were having, you know, daily briefings in one way or another, putting out statements. We read everything that they said. Generally, that's dealing with kind of administration issues. And technically, I shouldn't have been involved in those. And I look back on it now and regret. I think I went over the line in terms of arguing why we should be doing what we should be doing.
In what sense do you think you went over the line?
Well, as a military spokesperson, I should be arguing the conduct of doing what we're doing, not why we should be doing it. Because either the president gives the order or he doesn't. And in a lot of ways, that's none of my business. If he gives the order, then I need to make sure we conduct it in the best way possible. And that's what I explain is kind of the conduct of our actions and what's going on, what we're doing, and how we're doing it. But not necessarily why we're proceeding with these actions, other than to say the president and the nation have ordered us to. And yet I look back on particularly my communications online. I started a program at Central Command where I would, before the war, I would spend every waking minute I had that wasn't doing something else online. And I would go into chat rooms at NPR, at New York Times, Washington Post, Oprah, MTV, foreign chat rooms. And they would be debating the war. There'd be entire, you know, strains about the war. And a lot of times there's so much information that kind of takes on a life of its own there. I would say, and boy, talk about putting yourself out there for put a target on your chest. Say, hello, I'm a spokesperson for Central Command. I'm in the desert right now, and I can answer any of your questions. And I kind of like to address some of the stuff you're talking about. And so I would address a lot of the stuff that I felt was misinformation. I would try to give them my sources. And I would spend about 14 hours a day doing that.
Would you choose a story that you had to work on, a news story, and compare how it was covered in the American press and in Al Jazeera, or compare how it was covered in different parts of the American press and in Al Jazeera?
One of my challenges and frustrations was I didn't have a translator. So I actually had no idea how they were covering the story on Al Jazeera.
Why didn't you have a translator?
I think the need for translators was much greater on the front lines. And that's something that I go back and forth on. I can completely understand that. If I was a guy up on the front lines, and I often wish I was, when I volunteered to go, I didn't necessarily volunteer to go to CENTCOM. I just wanted to go over to be with the Marines at the war. I would definitely want a translator. I'm going village to village, and there's only so many translators. So that's clearly where the focus was. If we had translators at CENTCOM, they were probably over in the planning cell or places where they were needed to be kind of closer to the action in a sense. Then again, if you look at the long-term impact of, you know, the media on the war, and particularly the impact of the Arab press on not just the war in Iraq, but this entire clash of civilizations, I guess is maybe a good way to put it. Who's to say which is more important?
We're hearing from former U.S. Marine Corps Captain Josh Rushing, who was a prominent figure in the documentary Control Room. The film is just out on DVD. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with former U.S. Marine Captain Josh Rushing, who's featured in the documentary Control Room.
You know, in the movie, you say that you know, you're describing the spectrum of the press, and you describe Fox News as being at the other end of the spectrum from Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera presents itself to an Arab national audience, and that's reflected in their coverage. Fox News plays to a patriotic American audience, and that's reflected in their coverage. What reaction did you get to that, and what led you to that conclusion of making some kind of analogy of Fox on the one end of the spectrum and Al Jazeera on the other?
If you have conducted interviews, given interviews to both those stations, I think you would clearly see it. Before a Fox interview, for example, while you're mic'd up and you're waiting with the reporter, he may say, I'll tell you what, what points do you want to get across in this interview? And I would give him our three speaking points, our messages. And he'll go, okay, I'll tell you, I'll ask you this one, and then I'll segue into this, and then we'll transition into this. But I need to ask you about this other one. So do you have something you can say about that? Yeah, sure, I can come up with something with that. So it's like a huddle. You script it out, and then you do your two minutes live, and it's great. And the Fox crowd, many of whom I know and am related to, love to see that because it makes the military look really great. And the military is great. Don't get me wrong. The military is great. Al Jazeera, on the other hand, will, well, for example, on this one particular day after the Jessica Lynch ambush, and America was saying that it was against the Geneva Conventions for them have to shown the footage of the POWs on television. Al Jazeera wanted an interview with me, so we go outside and set it up into the hot desert sun and the sand blowing, and I'm staring into the sand, and there's a very kind engineer who's friendly, and he puts a translator's piece in my ear. The girl introduces herself as the translator, and she sounds very young and kind of sweet, has a lilting accent as if she learned Arabic through maybe BBC or some kind of British influence. And we go into the questions, and I can't see the person I'm talking to. And as she's asking me the questions, her voice is so nice, I find myself kind of smiling and nodding along. And then I realize, wait a second, that's a combative question. And I bet he didn't just say it over there. I've watched the Dutch Al Jazeera, and I don't even understand what they're saying. He probably yelled it on the other side, you know. And here I am smiling and nodding my head. And the questions would be along the lines of, the Geneva Convention was written by the UN, and the UN opposes the war. So why should Saddam abide by the Geneva Convention? And it takes you just a second to stop and think about it and think, I think the Geneva Convention was written in the late 1920s. I think the UN was started in the mid-1940s. So there's about a 20-year gap there where the Geneva Convention predates the UN, so it couldn't be written by it. And I'm sure the UN is not against the war because it never passed a resolution against the war. So your question is built on a couple of false premises, and then kind of get back to, well, what I think is important is that, you know, we want to treat your POWs with dignity, and we hope that you do ours as well. And then what I didn't even know at the time, and I found out later, was while I'm talking about that, there's a split screen, and they're showing a market bombing in Baghdad that has nothing to do with what we're talking about, and I have no idea that they're showing it. But if you watch the TV on mute, it clearly looks like I'm responding to the attack in downtown Baghdad.
You said that in the military, while you were at CENTCOM, during the war in Iraq, that you were behind closed doors an advocate for Al Jazeera. There were times when you felt that Al Jazeera was overly combative and that they were misrepresenting the story when they were interviewing you. So why were you an advocate for them?
There's really one voice that reaches so much of the Arab population. And I look at the invasion of Iraq as not just about Iraq, but about this clash of civilizations that really created 9/11. I mean, the roots of 9/11 are the Arab perspective. And the best way to reach those who hold that perspective is through Al Jazeera. Now, when Al Jazeera would conduct themselves in such a way like they did on the interview that we talked about, where they would ask me really unfair questions, and then they would split the screen without me knowing it, things like that, my office would often kind of knee-jerk and say, that's it, no more for Al Jazeera. No more interviews, no more access. They're unfair, they're unbalanced. And so I would find myself arguing, and if I was the only one who believed it, it wouldn't have happened. I mean, I was a junior guy on the totem pole, but fortunately, Captain Frank Thorpe, who was in charge of the media operation there, was a terrifically intelligent individual, and he also saw the importance of it. But I would find myself arguing that, hey, these are the people why we're here. I mean, what's the point of even being here if you're not going to talk to the people about it? By the people, I mean the people of this region. And the way you do that is through Al Jazeera. You don't do it through some station that we've created. It obviously has no credibility. You got to do it through their media sources, and that is so important. So it was important then, and I think it's still important today.
Do you think that the United States makes a mistake when it does cut off access to Al Jazeera?
I think not only do they make a mistake when they cut off access to Al Jazeera, and believe me, I always believe in holding Al Jazeera accountable. And when you go on and you do the interviews with him, you tell him why you're holding him accountable. And General John Abizay did a terrific job of that after the Jessica Lynch thing. At a press conference we had right after that, the daily briefing, Al Jazeera was worried that they weren't going to get called on because they knew that we were angry about it. But rather, General Abizay immediately called on Al Jazeera, and before he took the question, I think after he took the question, but before he responded to the question, he told them that he thought it was horrible what they did and why. And then he answered their question. And I talked to that reporter afterward, and he thought that was just great because of he got a fair answer to the question that he asked. So I think the U.S. makes a mistake when they don't engage Al Jazeera. And honestly, I think the U.S. made a mistake by making me the lead point of contact for Al Jazeera.
Why?
Early on in the planning, they should have identified this as mission critical, the way we're perceived on Al Jazeera. And they should have had somebody there who possibly spoke Arabic, has some kind of training in Middle Eastern affairs. The best extent of my knowledge, I went to a Borders bookstore before we left the country, and I bought a couple of Bernard Lewis books, and I bought Iraq for Dummies. The Bernard Lewis books were okay. They're a little dry. I was on the plane. The Iraq for Dummies was phenomenal. It was great because it broke it apart in like easily digestible parts that I could kind of regurgitate. I knew every simple fact about Iraq you could know. So when I checked the board there in CENTCOM in Doha, they thought I was some kind of Iraqi expert because I could spout off all these percentages of this and that that I'd gotten right from the Iraq for Dummies book. So you have probably 40 people, military people, working at the media center. I'd say a dozen of them have been identified as camera people, guys who are going to go in front of the camera and do spokesperson-type work. Actually, those are spokespeople who are doing radio and print and everything else. Four or five of those actually go in front of the camera kind of regularly. And I'm the junior-ranking guy. There's one other guy who's ranked as low as me, a Navy guy. And I've got Al Jazeera. There's something wrong with that. It goes all the way back to the beginning of the planning. They should have had someone far more qualified than a guy with, you know, Iraq for Dummies in his back pocket talking about national security issues to 45 million Arabs during a war.
Josh Rushing, a prominent figure in the documentary Control Room. The film has just been released on DVD. We'll hear more from Rushing in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Daedalus Books, Remainders for Readers, holiday catalog at 800-395-2665 or SALEBOOKS.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, leaving the military he loved, we continue our conversation with former Marine Captain Josh Rushing. He was featured in the documentary Control Room. Also, John Powers reviews The Battle of Algiers, about the Algerian struggle for independence. The movie was made nearly 40 years ago and has just come out on DVD. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's return to Terry's interview with former U.S. Marine Corps Captain Josh Rushing, who resigned from his post this month. Rushing was the Central Command, or CENTCOM, press officer seen in the documentary Control Room. Control Room is just out on DVD. Terry spoke to Rushing earlier this week and asked about his work at CENTCOM.
While you were the public affairs officer at CENTCOM during the war in Iraq, did you ever feel like any of the positions you were expected to give or any of the explanations or descriptions you're expected to give were either pure spin or whether you were involved in what some people in the press described as overmanaging the news?
I felt like we had too much White House influence over what we were doing. I should tell you that I was a first lieutenant at the time, and in the eyes of the military, I have no right to express such an opinion. But there's a colonel in charge of public affairs at CENTCOM. He was an Air Force colonel with 30 years experience, and he's an excellent guy. For the war, and for the war only, the White House took one of its guys, an insider there, and put him in charge of as the strategic director of communications at CENTCOM. He is a civilian who worked on the Bush campaign and worked in the White House. And so now he's in charge, and so they give him a two-star rank, two-star equivalent. It's called an SES. It's a way you can give civilians kind of equivalent rank. So he's over the colonel now. He's a 32, probably 33-year-old guy now from Texas, whom I like and respect very much. And bringing him in did certain things. Like that internet thing I was talking about that I started earlier, mm-hmm. He was the one who visualized that. He really had a lot of ideas that were outside the box of the normal military tools that we use. And I think that was really beneficial. However, it also brought in a White House insider to control the message for the war. And then there were three other White House people that came and had a little separate office right next to our office as spokespeople. In such a tight quarters as the media center was, this was all obvious and apparent. And so we often, as military spokespeople, which should be nonpartisan, lost credibility because of that. One particularly sharp reporter who was with AP, that will remain nameless, would often call us to task saying that we were political flacks. You know, how could she buy what we were saying? You're political flacks, putting out the message. And that's really hurtful as a military spokesperson because you're supposed to be kind of an honest broker of the truth.
What would you say to that?
During the war, we would argue that and say, absolutely not. We are we're putting out the truth, and you know, everything I'm telling you is true as I know it. It's not political. After the war, I think in confidence, I probably told her, you know, there were times that I felt like it was a little politicized.
What was an example of one of those times?
That's a great question. Well, while Baghdad's being looted, there's a scene in the movie where Captain Frank Thorpe, who's probably the best spokesperson or one of the best spokespeople I've ever met and had the honor to serve with, is arguing with this AP reporter and... She's tearing him up about Baghdad being looted and how we've basically implied that it's Iraqis' responsibility to not do that. It's being looted by Iraqis, so how can you hold us accountable? And that's such a political message. We just took over the town. Surely we're in charge of security.
When you're a press spokesman for the military, is it considered bad form to ever say, we made a mistake? You know, like, if people in the military... felt that perhaps they should have taken more responsibility to prevent the looting that went on in Iraq after the invasion. Could a military press spokesman have said, "Well, we could have done a better job, or we made a mistake," or is that a place you just never go?
I've been accused of being an optimist, and it's a criticism that I'll accept. In Josh's world, on Josh's planet. Absolutely, you say we've made a mistake, and here's what we're going to do to fix it. I think there have probably been times in my 14-year career where you did do that, and you could say that. I believe there's a culture now where that's unacceptable, where you can never say that anything's other than rosy perfect. You can never admit a mistake. I think that culture goes all the way up to the White House. When in the second debate they asked President Bush, can you name three simple mistakes that you regret or would do differently now that you're in the White House, and he couldn't name one. That I find that kind of hubris disturbing, and I think the rest of the world finds it kind of arrogant and even beyond arrogant, almost disillusional at times.
You have expressed some feelings of having been misled, for instance, about weapons of mass destruction and having had to give a message that turned out to not be true. Sounds like you've been a little disillusioned by the interactions between the White House and the military. And I'm wondering if you think your opinions were shared by other people who you interacted with in the military. Or if you
Absolutely.
Feel like you're a loner on this.
No, I don't. I feel, I think there was a recent survey that said something like 3 out of 4 or 4 out of 5 people in the military are generally Republican. And I think that's been true for most of the time I've been in. But in the last year or two, I've heard more anti-administration sentiments in the military than I've ever heard before, without a doubt. And I think a lot of people, those who have had the hardest times in Iraq, they tend to go kind of polarized both ways. Some are very, very strong supporters of the administration, and I think for them they need to be, so that what they did does mean something and is important. I think they feel like if Bush is wrong, or was wrong in what he did, then somehow that takes away the meaning for what they've sacrificed, which I hope isn't true. And then others are polarized quite the other way, that realize how much they've sacrificed and feel like it may have been for a poor decision or something along those lines.
It strikes me you're in a very interesting and difficult position right now. After years of being a spokesperson for the military, interacting with the American press and the Arab press, you're no longer with the military. You've only been out about 2 weeks. And now you're speaking, as we hear right now, to the American press, and you no longer have to follow the military guidelines. You no longer have to speak on behalf of the military. So I guess I'm really wondering how you seem to be a very reflective person. So what was the process of reflecting like before beginning to give interviews as a non-military, as a former military person, and deciding what you were going to be comfortable saying, what you should keep confidential, what you would consider to be a betrayal of your, you know, military friends, and what honesty requires you to say, and so on?
That's an amazingly insightful question, and I'll tell you why. This is the first interview I've given, and I had trouble sleeping last night. I haven't really talked it over with anyone in the military. I haven't called my friends and said, "Hey, I think I may give an interview on this, and you know, where do you think I should draw the line?" And while I've given you this interview, I've felt myself say something and then think, "Wait a second, should I have said that?" And so it's a very very new experience for me, and I'm not sure where I set any of those boundaries yet, Terry.
Right.
That's a great question, something I guess I'm kind of struggling with internally.
Former U.S. Marine Corps Captain Josh Rushing, who was a prominent figure in the documentary Control Room. The film is just out on DVD. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with former U.S. Marine Captain Josh Rushing, who's featured in the documentary Control Room.
Can you elaborate on why you left the military?
I think there are a lot of reasons, but there was a point where when they said you can't speak to the press about control room, that my frustration reached kind of a peak level, and I think finally said, that's it. That's it. I'm done with this. I'm out. Because it was so frustrating that, particularly, the movie came out there in Abu Ghraib. So you have all this terrible stuff coming out about the military, and then here comes this movie that shows somebody that people seem to really respond to positively. And even Frank Rachel in the New York Times, that while Private England, I think, represents kind of some of the worst of what we have, what I did in Control Room represents the best of what we had. So I would have liked to have gone out there, and I would have liked to have given America the message, because I had a lot of requests, to include your show, to come on and speak. And I wanted to give America the message that it wasn't just me, that I was, that there are a million others like me in the armed services who would have responded very similarly to the way I responded. Because some articles started to craft it as if I was some kind of rogue sympathizer, you know, it's like the mean military over here and me holding the righteous, you know, the banner of truth over here kind of thing. And that's not true. There are legions in the military like me. So I wanted to put that message out there. But the Pentagon, with Headquarters Marine Corps, without even watching the film, I think just made a poor decision and said it's easier to say no. And I don't think they realized how big the movie was going to be or how many requests they were going to have from the military. And they were dealing with other things that were bigger. And they'd read that article that I did in the Village Voice where I said that war was horrible, which to this day I don't think is a bad message for a Marine. Any warrior should say war is horrible. We're supposed to be reluctant warriors. So I think they just found it easier to say no. And I found that beyond disappointing. I found it frustrating, and not just disappointing in that decision, but disappointed in my institution that it would handle it in that way and miss an opportunity to build up others. And there were even some in the Pentagon who said I was kind of accused me of being after my 15 minutes of fame, which was particularly hurtful because, one, it personalized the issue. Two, I didn't volunteer to do the movie I was ordered to. Three, I thought it was a student film for the American University at Cairo. I didn't know it was going to be this big thing. I don't even think Jahan, the filmmaker, knew how big it would eventually go. So it's kind of a ludicrous assumption, but it's the way some reacted. And I just felt like maybe I would be wanted somewhere else.
When you decided to leave the military, was it hard to leave with the stop-loss policy?
No. The Marine Corps does not have a stop-loss policy right now, so it was not hard technically to leave. And in terms of Headquarters Marine Corps, who, although I was working in an office in Los Angeles, I fell under Headquarters Marine Corps at the Pentagon. I think they were kind of happy to see me go. I never heard a whole lot of negative stuff about the movie from them. After they gave me the order not to speak, there was a point where my wife started doing interviews, and she gave an interview to the Washington Post and a few other, I think Salon.com, some others, and I got a heated email from a lieutenant colonel at the Pentagon asking me to stop my back channel media campaign with my wife, so basically to silence her. And I think he thought that I was kind of beating her messages to give the press, where in truth, I asked her not to do them, but she is an extremely loyal person and felt that it was her duty and right to do those interviews, and so I made sure I wasn't around when she did them. I didn't want to know about them afterwards, so that they were something that she did out of her own conscience and I wasn't a part of. So, again, the accusations became personal and were inaccurate. The most difficult part about leaving was not the stop loss. It was the emotional separation for me because of I'm just such a Marine at heart.
Do you miss them?
Oh, yeah. I still go by my office and see the guys that used to work for me. You know, the staff sergeant, the sergeant. We're still going to go running together. Of course I miss the Marines. My email is once a Marine at, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, I miss the Marines.
Okay.
I think I always will.
Do you know what you're going to do next?
I don't know what I'm going to do next. I'm going to find a job, hopefully, soon, and support my family. That'd make my wife feel a lot better. But otherwise, no, I don't. And it's kind of funny because of someone else asked me this recently. I said in the movie that, you know, when I get out, I'd really like to do something about that Palestine situation, which is when you're in the Middle East, everything goes back to Israel and Palestine. And that's one of the things I learned over there was in America, the invasion of Iraq and whatever is happening in Israel, there is no connection. Most people will recognize that they're geographically in the same part of the world, but other than that, there is no connection. Over there, they are one in the same. It is an Arab struggle against Western power. And so everything goes back. I think Hassan says in the movie that if a water line breaks in Damascus, it's an Israeli conspiracy. And so having spent 6 months there, and not just, you know, 6 months reading a book, but 6 months every day embroiled in this controversy, kind of in the middle of it, you become very wrapped up in it. And to this day, I would love to do something if I could, but I feel like, wow, I'm not even Captain Josh Rushing anymore. I'm just Josh Rushing. I don't know how much, you know, reach I have to help with the Palestinian situation that, you know, the UN and everyone else isn't probably already addressing. Plus, I think now that I'm back in America, my life, kind of have the comfort of, and all Americans enjoy this comfort of being absorbed in our own lives so much that the rest of the world doesn't matter as much. And I find myself caught in that right now. Like, I guess it's Maslow's hierarchy. I'm back to looking for food and shelter before I can move on to higher endeavors.
We're about out of time, so I'm going to change the subject and ask you one last question. During an earlier part of your military career, you were a liaison to Hollywood, and you worked with them on, I think, how the military was represented in scripts?
You know, not just during an early part. That's what I was doing when I went to the war, and the war was just 6 months out of that job in Hollywood. They took me away for 6 months, and then I came back to it, and that's the job I just left a couple of weeks ago.
Oh.
And, yeah, I was reading scripts, and I was a liaison to Hollywood. So if a production, and the most obvious example is JAG, wants to use some of our, say, helicopters, they would send me the script. I would review it and say, you know, this represents us accurately or not. And if I felt it did represent us accurately, then we could provide them some helicopters or allow them to fill helicopters that were doing normal training anyway. If the helicopters weren't doing their normal training and they were going to do something specific for the director, then I charged them exactly what it cost the American people to operate that helicopter for those minutes to include the crew, the fuel, maintenance, everything, and the production paid for it. So it was at no cost to the American people. The military really uses that opportunity in Hollywood. They recognize that opportunity in Hollywood as a chance to educate the American public on what we do. I mean, like it or not, a lot of people are really educated about a number of issues through the entertainment world.
Well, maybe we could talk about that on a subsequent interview. What's your
I'd
favorite?
Be happy to.
What's your favorite movie or TV show involving, you know, that represented the American military?
Oh gosh, I'm the worst to watch movie or TV with military in it, and my wife just won't do it with me anymore. She has reached her limit, and she loves one of the shows I worked on, Navy NCIS with Mark Harmon, and we have a TiVo, and she record it and watch it when I'm not around because of. It's just impossible not to pick it apart. If you watched a show about a radio interview host, it would drive you nuts, all the things that they would do that you just know they couldn't get away with.
Got it.
So it's hard to say. But Navy NCIS with Mark Harmon, it's a pretty good show. West Wing, we worked with a lot, and that's an excellent show as well.
Well, Josh Rushing, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you. It's been a real honor to be a participant of your show.
Former Marine Corps Captain Josh Rushing was the Central Command, or CENTCOM, press officer seen in the documentary Control Room. Control Room has just been released on DVD. That's Leonard Bernstein's Ohio from the show Wonderful Town, performed by the Bill Charlap Trio. Coming up, John Powers on the DVD release of The Battle of Algiers. This is Fresh Air. The nearly 40-year-old political film, The Battle of Algiers, returned to theaters briefly last year. It was even screened at the Pentagon. Now it's out on DVD, and our critic at large, John Powers, says it's a movie for our times as well.
The world was a different place when the Italian director Gillo Pontecorvo made The Battle of Algiers, his film about the Algerian struggle for independence from the French. When the movie came out in 1965, it was bitterly attacked by the European right. Movie theaters were bombed in France. But over the next years, it was embraced by would-be leftist guerrillas. On American college campuses, you'd sometimes hear oodle-oodle-oodle-oodle, the eerie ululations that the Algerian women used as a kind of battle cry. Here's what they actually sounded like. But we undergrads weren't the only ones watching. The Battle of Algiers became a how-to guide to urban insurrection for radicals throughout the Middle East. The Algerian model has influenced everyone from Al-Qaeda to the fascist insurgents in Iraq, which is why today Pontecorvo's movie is being screened by the Pentagon to help members of special ops understand the daunting complexities of urban rebellion. The story is set in the two different parts of the city of Algiers, the prosperous French Quarter and the more squalid Algerian area known as the Casbah. And it focuses on two very different men. Ali Lapointe is a petty thief who becomes a leader for the Liberation Front, the NLF. He helps guide their terrorist murders and bombings. On the French side is Colonel Mathieu, who respects his adversaries but does not blink from the truth. And the truth, as he sees it, is that to crush such an insurgency requires absolute ruthlessness. That's why he resorts to the vilest forms of torture. Mathieu's brutal methods work, and he breaks the NLF's terror network. No matter, Algeria winds up independent. Pontecorvo shot the Battle of Algiers on location only 2 years after Algerian independence, and it remains an astonishing piece of filmmaking, from its grayed-out look, which makes you feel that you're watching a documentary, to the lucidity with which it lays out its story. Although the movie's clearly on the side of the Algerian nationalists, you can tell this from the great score by Ennio Morricone, it's not sentimental about the NLF, which is often depicted as being pointlessly violent. Nor is it cheaply judgmental of Colonel Mathieu, who the film respects for his own unblinkered realism in attacking terrorists. Even today, when we're accustomed to grisly footage, few scenes could be more chilling than the one in which three Algerian women bomb civilian targets in the French Quarter. These aren't the gleeful fireball and flying glass kapows of Hollywood action movies. They're realistic acts of terror, all the more powerful because of their human scale. When I first saw Battle of Algiers in the 1970s, I wished I knew more about Algeria. When I watched it again on DVD the other night, I didn't have to wish. The movie was just the first of a three-disc set packed with fascinating extras, including a 70-minute documentary on the Algerian rebellion. For me, the most gripping of these added features is an interview with contemporary anti-terrorism experts, including America's former anti-terror czar, Richard Clark. They analyze what the Battle of Algiers shows about our own situation in the post-9/11 world, be it the effectiveness of terrorism as a political tool, or the difficulties created by cracking down on terrorism. As Clark points out, the NLF terrorists didn't simply murder people in order to sow chaos. It was a tactic designed to invite reprisals that would turn the population against the French, which is exactly what happened. The French actually won the battle against terrorists in Algiers, but in the very process, they lost the political war. That's precisely the risk the U.S. faces in the larger war on terror, not to mention in its battles for specific Iraq cities like Baghdad and Fallujah. And no matter who's elected president this coming Tuesday, he'll have to deal with the great paradox of fighting terrorism. You can often lose by winning. Which is why I wouldn't be surprised to hear that the Battle of Algiers DVD has turned up at the White House. Made nearly four decades ago, it's this year's most relevant movie.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and the author of Sore Winners. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Weird U.S., your travel guide to America's local legends and best-kept secrets, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging Americans to learn about ways to reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease, on the web at alz.org. And by Harcourt, publishers of A Tale of Love and Darkness, the memoir of growing up in war-torn Jerusalem and the life of Israeli writer Amos Oz, author of The Same Sea. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, stand-up comic George Carlin on language, taboos, and his seven dirty words routine that was the center of a famous obscenity case in the 1970s. His new book is When Will Jesus Bring the Pork Chops? Join us for the next Fresh Air.